the Center for Adolescent Health and the Law, over the past several years, we periodically get phone calls from people in different states, healthcare professionals, school-based health centers, adolescent clinics, who are taking care of young people who are insured, who have some kind of insurance coverage, sometimes through a public program like Medicaid or the State Children's Health Insurance Program, and often through a private insurance plan of some kind, which is usually through their parents' insurance. And so the question is always, how can we deliver confidential care without these young people and our site having to forfeit the benefits of the insurance coverage that they actually have and that somebody is paying for on their behalf, if it's private insurance, either their parents or their parents' employer. And I really haven't had a good answer for people when they've called. So over the course of the last year or two, we've initiated a small project to work on these issues, and we're delighted when Gail and her colleagues in New York took the initiative to establish this stakeholders task force to really try and get this amazing group of people to sit down together around the table, all motivated to do the best thing for adolescents and to help them get confidential care when they need confidential care, and then also cognizant of the fact that there is sort of a maze of legal requirements out there in the world at the federal and state level that make it very challenging to do exactly that. So we haven't solved the problems yet, but I think that the task force that Gail spearheaded has really taken some, you know, wonderful steps in the direction of understanding sort of where exactly the challenges are and what we need to do to solve them. So what I'm going to do this morning is walk us fairly quickly through, as Gail said, an understanding of when minors have the right to consent for health care and when that care is confidential and what the implications are for insurance. And I'm going to start by saying a few things about why confidential services are so important for teens, because I think it's always a good idea to come back to that sort of base in reminding ourselves why we care about this. There are extensive, over the past two or three decades, research findings on the implications of adolescents' privacy concerns. And the studies that have been done have documented in very significant ways that privacy concerns can lead adolescents to avoid seeking care, to stop using services entirely, to change the site or provider that they go to decline specific services, often that might be STD testing, and to limit how candid and honest and open and thorough they are in talking with their healthcare providers about their behaviors and their symptoms and their healthcare needs. There are some very strong health-related rationales for protecting confidentiality, and they have to do with really trying to avoid negative health outcomes, both for individual adolescents themselves and also for the public. There are also very practical and pragmatic reasons for protecting confidentiality. If healthcare conversations between adolescents and their healthcare providers cannot be private, then many teens will not seek care. And many teens don't really have very many opportunities for frank discussion of these kinds of sensitive health topics, including, you know, not only sexual health topics, although those for our purposes at this conference are front and center, but also mental health and substance use issues, which can indirectly contribute to issues that are related to sexual health and STDs. It's also the case that really adolescents need to begin the process of learning to become independent agents in the healthcare system, independent consumers of healthcare, because they can't just sort of grow up, reach the age of 18, and suddenly miraculously know how to deal with their own health care. So that needs to begin much earlier, and being able to talk candidly and privately with their health care providers is one element of that. So let's spend a couple of minutes looking at the consent issues. Obviously, for minors who are under the age of 18, the basic rule for health care is that parental consent is required, or some alternative to parental consent, such as the consent of a foster parent or a court or a related caretaker, possibly a social worker or a probation officer if the court delegates the authority to them. And then a huge area, which is what's particularly relevant to the topic we're talking about today, is minor consent. Consent by the adolescent himself or herself for either all of their own health care or a particular kind of health care services. And as Gail mentioned, all 50 states and the District of Columbia do have minor consent laws. And some of these laws are based on the status of the minor, and some of them are based on the services that the minor is seeking. And those laws, by the way, were first enacted beginning more than half a century ago. The first law that I'm familiar with was in California in 1953, which provided that married minors could give their own consent for pregnancy-related care. It seems unfathomable today to think that a married minor would not be able to give her own consent for health care, but that was the case in California in 1953 because they wouldn't have had to enact a law about it otherwise. There's been a progression of such laws expanding over the last half century, and in the last decade or two, we've actually seen attempts to repeal some of those laws that have been on the books for as much as 30 years and have worked very successfully to improve and support healthcare access for adolescents. The sort of menu of different kinds of status that states pick and choose from when they pass their minor consent laws that allow minors to consent based on their status is listed here. And very few states have all of these laws, but every state has some. And the most common ones are for married minors, for minors who are living apart from their parents, for emancipated minors. And then the other categories vary in terms of how many states have adopted them. The mature minor doctrine is something that has really grown up over the years by the courts. It has been included in statute in a few states, and it is a doctrine which says that if a minor has the capacity to give informed consent and does make a voluntary decision, and the care is within the mainstream of regular medical practice, that it is not negligent for the provider to give care based on the minor's own consent, and that's a very important doctrine. The consent laws that are based on services, again, there's a menu and states pick and choose among these, but notable for today's discussion, every state has a law that allows in some fashion minors to consent for STD-related care, usually diagnosis and treatment, and a small handful of states include prevention. There's a very strong relationship, but not an absolutely complete overlap between consent laws and confidentiality protections. The phrase consent and confidentiality is often used almost as if it were one word, and it is true that minor consent laws often do contain provisions regarding confidentiality and disclosure, but they don't always do that. So one does, from a legal perspective, have to look at confidentiality slightly apart from or distinct from consent requirements. In addition to the laws, it's important to know that there are professional organization policies by virtually every healthcare professional organization that support both confidentiality in general and also confidentiality for adolescents. And my center compiled a compendium of those policies, and it can be downloaded off of our website at www.cahl.org. And there are policies of more than 20 professional healthcare organizations with regard to adolescent confidentiality. The confidentiality laws come from diverse sources in both state law and federal law. And of course, I'm sure all of you in the room have encountered the federal HIPAA privacy rule, which is complex and highly relevant. I think perhaps the next speaker is going to talk a little bit about how some of the HIPAA requirements are relevant. But specifically, as far as minors are concerned, when they are able to consent for their own health care and do consent, the HIPAA privacy rule treats them sort of as an individual who has the rights that other individuals have, adults have, under the HIPAA privacy rule in terms of access to information and control over disclosure of information and requesting special privacy protections. But there is one big exception in that minors are treated differently from adults under the HIPAA privacy rule, and the way in which that occurs has to do with whether parents do or do not have access to the information about care for which minors have given their own consent. And this was the product of a long debate and a lot of negotiation and a compromise that resulted in the HIPAA privacy rule itself deferring to other laws that said state or other applicable laws. And so if those other laws require disclosure to parents, that's what controls. If they prohibit disclosure to parents, that's what controls. And if they permit it or are silent, then the health care provider, which could be the health plan, makes the determination. And the most relevant laws for confidentiality purposes for minors are really the state minor consent laws. And they do contain often some explicit provisions about protecting confidentiality, but they also often contain a grant of discretion to the physician or healthcare professional to disclose information if they believe that it's in the best interests or necessary for the health of the young person. There are, of course, limits to confidentiality, which have to do with the mandated reporting of abuse and neglect, with concerns about imminent serious harm to health or others, and then, of course, most relevant for today, insurance billing and other issues such as, you know, when medical records may be discoverable in litigation or whether signed office agreements about confidentiality have legal validity, although they were given added legal validity by the HIPAA privacy rule. And again, there are laws mandating things, disclosure, that have to do with parental notification provisions. Those mostly are in the arena of abortion, child abuse reporting statutes, and disclosure requirements when minors are dangerous to themselves or others. Finally, I'm going to close with just a few comments about confidentiality and insurance, which I think really raises a whole host of conundrums and paradoxes that we're going to have to solve over the next, over the coming years. If not the coming months. And those paradoxes and conundrums emerge from the fact that, as we've seen, state laws do allow minors to consent for their own health care, and federal and state laws do protect the confidentiality of that care. But federal and state laws, as we'll hear in the following presentations, also do require the issuance of explanations of benefits and other disclosures to policyholders, who are usually parents, particularly in the commercial insurance setting. And federal law also requires notification of denials of claims in commercial insurance and also in Medicaid. So we're really confronted with some very real challenges in this area that we need to address. And some of the questions we'll need to answer are which of the laws take precedence, because when you have conflicting laws, there's not always an automatic answer as to which one actually controls. And can those laws be reconciled in some way that will work to the benefit of adolescents? And if the laws requiring explanations of benefits, notices of denials of claims, and other disclosures are the ones that are determined to take precedence, is there still some mechanism, some way, some methodology whereby we can deliver confidential care to adolescents without their having to forfeit their insurance coverage? So.